Okay, now about sex. Bottom of page 68. Many of us needed an overhauling there. Now, you older fellas, don't get your hopes up. We're not talking about physical, we're talking about mental. But above all, we tried to be sensible on this question. It's so easy to get way off the track. Here we find human opinions running into extremes, absurd extremes perhaps. One set of voices cry that sex is a lust of our lower nature, a base necessity of procreation. And you and I have heard them all of our lives, as far back as I can remember. They're the ones that say sex is a dirty thing. You're only supposed to do it for one purpose, to reproduce yourself. You're only supposed to do it with one person at one time in one position. And to enjoy it is a very sinful thing. I've heard them as far back as I can remember. They are to the extremes on one side. Then we have the voices who cry for sex and more sex, who bewail the institution of marriage, who think that most of the troubles of the race are traceable to sex causes. They think we do not have enough of it, or it isn't the right kind. You hear them today. They're the ones that say you ought to be able to have sex any time you want to, with anybody you want to, as many times as you want to. You ought to be able to enjoy it every time, and if you don't, there must be something wrong with you. Maybe they call that the sexual revolution. Main thing I see wrong with it happened 25 years too late for Joe and I to participate in.
Missed the whole thing.
Joe said he just missed the whole damn thing. With that one school would allow man no flavor for his fare, and the other would have us all on a straight pepper diet. We want to stay out of this controversy. We do not want to be the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct. We all have sex problems. We'd hardly be human if we didn't. What can we do about them? And I read that last statement with great relief, because I knew this book was getting ready to condemn me for what I had been in the past. I knew it was getting ready to tell me what I was going to have to do in the future. And I'd already made up my mind that I wasn't going to pay any attention to it whatsoever. And I'm real glad to find out we're not going to be the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct. We simply are not going to get into that issue. You know, if we start trying to tell people how to conduct their sex lives, then surely we're going to begin to alienate people. And the purpose of this book is to be helpful, not to alienate others. Besides that, what's sexually acceptable in one part of the world may not be acceptable at all in another part of the world. So we're simply not going to get it into that issue at all. What we are going to do is see a way to look at our own past sex life, to look at our own ideas about sex, to see if perhaps we've harmed some people through the sexual act in some way, to see if maybe we can't develop a new sex life in the future, where we can still engage in it and enjoy it, yet at the same time not harm other people. And basically, that's exactly what we're after, to be able to have a sex life that's decent and good at the same time, not hurt other people and still be able to enjoy it. Joe?
I'm like Charlie. I don't want to be the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct, and certainly I needed an overhauling there. And when I tell you where I got my information about sex, you'll not want to talk to me about it, I can tell you that. And if we're going to do what we did with the other resentment and fear, we're simply going to find the facts, we're going to face the facts, and we're going to engage in the process so we can accept the facts. And again, Dr. Jung said, ideas, emotions, and attitudes, which were the guiding force of their lives of these people, are suddenly cast to one side. Where did I get my ideas, emotions, and attitudes about sex? Well, when I was about 12 or 13 years old, we had sex education in school. They call it recess. And I got to thinking a lot about this. And I went to my mom. My dad had just got out of the nut house, and he was living in California. Couldn't talk to him about it. So I went to Mom, and I said, Mom, I've been thinking about sex. And it scared her to death. She said, oh, my God, Benny Joe. That's my name, Benny Joe. Yeah. Oh, my God, Benny Joe. She said, that's not a good thing to be thinking about. She said, you're only supposed to have sex when you want to have children. And I thought, well, see, she had five children. She had sex five times. My dad, no wonder he was in the nut house, you know. And she said, besides that, you're supposed to, it's a dirty, filthy, rotten thing to do, and you're supposed to save it for the one you love. Think about that. I don't know where she got all that from. I guess from the Southern Baptists, I suppose. But anyhow, I somehow didn't quite believe what she was telling me. So I went to the only source of information that was available to me, and on the corner of 21st and Quanah, not Southwest Boulevard, 21st and Quanah, there was a little restaurant called the Jenkins Cafe, and all the kids hung around the Jenkins Cafe, the older kids. And there was a bunch of older, wiser, intelligent, experienced men and women of about 15 or 16 years old. And they were more than happy to share everything they knew about it. And boy, as they began to tell me how often they were going out with these little girls, two or three different girls a night, they said, and how often they were having sex, my eyes got to be that big around. My ears got real big. I was really interested. Now, the fallacy of all this is that I was sober in Alcoholics Anonymous for a couple of years before I figured out that they were lying to me. Or at least I hope they were lying. I don't know. But I based my sex life upon what I heard on the streets. You think I didn't need an inventory in this area to find out what was true and what was not true? I did. And Charlie likes me to tell you the first time I had sex, I was selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, frightening, and inconsiderate, and I was also alone.
That's why he's wearing glasses today, too. Every time we say that, about a dozen of you guys whip your glasses off and put them in your pocket.
Well, I used to say jerk them off, but we quit saying that. I see we all need an inventory here this morning.
You can tell we're building up to spirituality, can't you? Next paragraph, we see a set of instructions on how to review our past sex life, worded almost the same as the instructions for resentments and fears, except worded a little differently, which is Bill's normal way of doing that. So let's take a look at this next paragraph, Joe.
Reviewed our conduct over the past years past. Where have we been selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate?
That's column 5.
Whom had we hurt?
That's column 1.
Did we justify arouse jealousy, suspicion, and bitterness?
Made that into column 4.
Were we at fault?
That's in column 4.
What should we have done instead? We got this all down on paper and looked at it. So we put down and start from the name, go down that column, always going from top to bottom.
So we gave you, to avoid confusion again, we gave you another little inventory sheet. We called it a review of our own sex conduct. Basically the same 5 type columns. Column 1. Who did I hurt? Now, I doubt if any of us in this room ever hurt anybody in the sexual area, and we don't know exactly who that is. Now, sometimes we might have a question on, well, what are the things we do to hurt people?
Bubba.
And we hurt people in the sexual area in many ways. You know, if I'm in a married relationship like I am, I go outside of my marriage and I have sex out there and my wife finds out about it, then certainly I've created a problem for her. But not physically, if not physically, at least emotionally. Sometimes we hurt people in a sexual area by demanding they have sex with us when they really don't want to. Surely we create a problem for them if we do that. If not physically, at least emotionally. Sometimes we hurt people in a sexual area that by demanding they do sexual things with us they really don't want to do. Surely when we do that, we create a problem for them, if not physically, at least emotionally. I think sometimes we hurt people in a sexual area simply by withholding sex when maybe we ought to give in more often. Many, many ways we hurt people in a sexual area. I think we all know what they are. I think we all know who we've hurt. Column 1, we begin to make that list. Column 2, what did I do to hurt them? You know, did I demand to have sex and didn't want to? Did I commit adultery? What was it I did to hurt them? If we know who we've hurt, we certainly know what we did. Column 3, affects mine. Now you would think that if I hurt anybody in a sexual area, it would be caused by the sex instinct. And I guess once in a while that's probably true. Sometimes to get the physical, the emotional gratification that comes at the moment of completion of the sex act, maybe I'm doing the wrong thing at the wrong time because of the sex instinct. But I think if I really carefully look at each situation, I'm going to find in the majority of the cases, the other two instincts are involved just as much as the sex instinct. And in many cases, I'll probably find that they are more at fault than the sex instinct, and sex really didn't have anything to do with that at all. Now I'm going to make a statement. I'm going to express an opinion. And I want to be sure everybody understands now this is my opinion. Not either one of these Joes, not AA's, but Charlie's opinion. I'm convinced today that God gave us the sex urge so that we could reproduce ourselves. I'm also convinced He made it a very pleasurable thing so we would do so. I don't think we would do the kind of work involved in sex if we didn't get some kind of reward for doing it. So if we're doing sex for purposes other than reproduction or enjoyment, then we just might be doing sex for purposes other than what God intended. For instance, we boys found out at a very early age that you can use sex to build your self-esteem. After all, the more members of the opposite sex you can attract to yourself, the greater man you really are, we thought. Now, we boys call that John Wayneism. I don't know what you girls called it.
Jane Wayne.
Jane Wayne, Joe said. Some of you girls tell me you use sex for the same purposes, to build the self-esteem. Now, if that's true, then that has nothing to do with reproduction or enjoyment. That's to fulfill a part of the social instinct rather than the sex instinct, and sex really doesn't have anything to do with that. Now, sometimes we use sex to buy a personal relationship. Maybe we're just lonesome. Maybe we just want somebody to pay attention to us. And we found out a long time ago we can give sex and buy back a personal relationship. That has nothing to do with reproduction or enjoyment. That is to fulfill also a part of the social instinct. Sex really doesn't have anything to do with that. Sometimes we use sex to buy security. Maybe we're in a sexual situation we really would rather not even be in. But we found out a long time ago we've become so emotionally over-dependent upon another human being for our material well-being that we give sex to buy back material security. Has nothing at all to do with the sex instinct. It is to fulfill the security instinct. Sometimes we use sex to get even with another human being. Maybe we're in a relationship, we find out our partner's gone out and done something they shouldn't do, and it infuriates the hell out of us. We say we'll show them, and we'll go out and do identically the same thing. The fallacy in it is, we can't afford to tell them we did it after we did it. But there we certainly didn't use sex to reproduce nor to enjoy. We used it to get even with another human being. Sex really doesn't have anything to do with that. Sometimes we use sex to force our will on another human being. Maybe our partner isn't doing what we think they ought to do, and we say, we'll show them. We'll just cut them off at the pass, and we won't let them have any sex till they come around our way of thinking. Now, we boys aren't very good at that. We only last 2 or 3 days. But you girls have honed it to perfection. You know exactly how to do that, and I don't blame you. I'd use it, too, if it worked that good for me. That has nothing to do with reproduction or enjoyment. That's to force our will on another human being. Sex really doesn't have anything to do with that. I think this third column is one of the greatest things we can do for ourselves when we honestly look at what's going on in our sex life. Two things begin to happen to me in the third column. Number one, a lot of guilt began to disappear. I thought I was just a dirty, rotten, no good SOB. But I found out that isn't true. I use sex for purposes other than what God intended, not because I'm a bad human being, because I'm a sick human being, and I use that sex to fulfill the other instincts of life, and sex really didn't have anything to do with it. I always thought I was oversexed. No, I wasn't oversexed, I was undersecure. And I use sex to build my self-esteem. I use sex to build my security, etc. And when I begin to see the truth behind it, that began to look kind of dumb to be doing that kind of stuff. The desire to go do it at the wrong time, in the wrong place, with the wrong person, began to become less and less and less when I actually could see the truth behind those sexual acts. And my desire to go do that became less. I began to get a handle on this sex thing right here in the third column. It's one of the greatest things I think we can do for ourselves. Column 4. What feelings did I create in others? Did I unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? What should I have done instead? You know, not only are we looking at the things we did to hurt another human being, we're going to try to shape a new sex life in the future. We need to be also looking at what should we have done instead of that. In column 4. Column 5. Same basic character defects. Did I do it through selfishness? Was it caused by dishonesty? Was it caused by being self-seeking and frightened? Was it caused by inconsideration of others? Every one of those sex acts is going to be at least one of those character defects, maybe a combination of every one of them in many, many cases. But in column 5, I simply put what the character defect was that is involved in this thing. When I get through with this sheet, I've got identically the same thing that I had on the resentment sheet and the fear sheet. I'm doing column 4. In the fifth column, we see the exact nature of the wrong. The wrong was the thing I did to hurt another human being. But what was at the core of it? Was it my selfishness, my dishonesty? What was the exact nature of it? Column 5, I see the character defects I'm going to become willing to turn loose of in step 6. Knowing if I stay selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, frightened, and inconsiderate, I'm going to keep on doing the same old things. Keep right on hurting people, and they're going to retaliate. In column 5, I see the shortcomings I'm going to ask God to take away in step 7. And quite naturally, all the names in column 1, they're going to be people that I've harmed through the sexual act. They're going to come off of this sheet and be added to the sheet to be used later on for steps 8 and 9. So when I'm through with this sheet, I've got the same thing I had for the other two manifestations of self. I'm going to have step 4. I'm going to have step 5, 6, and 7. I'm going to have steps 8 and 9, everything I need for my sexual conduct of the past.
I'm going to ask you, how many of you got your sexual information somewhat like I did? Somewhat. We need an inventory, don't we?
How many of you had sex the first time like he had?
Come on, be truthful now. You know, I remember when I first got married a couple of years there, I did okay, and then one night I went out on my wife. And the next day I felt terrible. I mean, I didn't know you were supposed to feel bad, but I did. I felt terrible. Guilty, shame, remorse, terrible. And those things are supposed to keep you from doing it again, but I didn't. I continued to do it from time to time. And the next time I did that, it wasn't quite so bad as the first time. And then the next time, it wasn't quite so bad as the time before. And as time went on, it got to where it didn't hurt at all. See, that's the principles. You know, if you don't have any principles to live by, ultimately, you don't have any reasons to live. That's how important principles are. That's why I needed to do what this book says. That's what I needed to do, and it says in the next paragraph, in this way, the way Charlie just described and the way the book just described, in this way, we tried to shape a sane and sound ideal for our future sex life. We suggested each relation to this test was it selfish or not. We have to use prayer 3 different times in the area of sex, and here's the first one. We ask God to mold our ideals and to help us to live up to them. We remembered always that our sex powers were God-given and therefore good, neither to be used lightly or selfishly, nor despised or loathed. Whatever our ideal turns out to be, we must be willing to grow toward it. We must be willing to make amends where we've done harm, provided that we do not bring about still more harm in so doing. In other words, we treat sex as we would any other problem. More prayer. In meditation, we ask God what we should do about each specific matter. The right answer will come if we want it.
You know, in this area of our lives, I know I've always had this knowledge. I've never been, it seemed like we always know in a sexual situation it's wrong, whether it's right or wrong. It's nothing new. I've never been in a sexual situation that was wrong that I didn't know it was wrong. So it says, let that work in your life. The right answer will come if we want it. God alone can judge our sex situation. God alone. That's great to know. Counsel that other persons are desirable, but we let God be the final judge. Realize that some people are fanatical about sex, others are loose. We avoid hysteria thinking our advice. You know, God, we know inside what we should do. And the only way we're going to develop that is use it and practice it in our lives. You know, we can only ask other people about that. And I think I see it happening around AA. You know, it's a bad place to get sexual advice. And financial advice in AA. So we let God be the final judge. We already know. I think we are the way in most cases. I talk to a lot of people, a lot of the problems every day in their lives. I've been doing that for years of what I do. And it dawned on me many years ago that everybody that comes to you with a problem, they already know the answer. Really, you can hear that they already know what to do. But they just don't want to adhere to it and do it. Okay. Suppose we fall short of the chosen idea and stumble. Does this mean we're going to get drunk? Some people tell us so, but this is only half true. It depends upon our motives. If we are not sorry for what we have done and have the honest desire to let God take us to better things, we believe we've forgiven and learned our lesson. But if we are not sorry and our conduct continues to harm others, we are quite sure to drink. We're not theorizing. These are facts of our experiences. You know, anything that we do that's going to hurt another person is wrong for us. This is a rule that we can always use. To sum up about sex, again, prayer. We earnestly pray for the right idea and for guidance in these questionable situations and for sanity and for the strength to do the right thing. If sex is very troublesome, we throw ourselves hard into helping others. We think of their needs and work for them. This takes us out of ourselves. It quiets the imperious urge.
The horny condition.
When the yield would mean
it quiets heartache. That horny condition is what it does.
And the yield would be heartache.
Okay, as I finished up this sexual inventory, went back and reviewed it again, looked at that column one, I was absolutely amazed to see in many cases the same names appearing on all three sheets. Barbara was on all three sheets. I resented her, I feared her, and I certainly hurt her in this area. I even had the Internal Revenue Service on all three sheets. I resented them and I feared them, and I gave them a pretty good screwing before I got to it. But I don't think we'll ever really tie all that stuff together in our head until we get these things down on paper and actually look at them and see the truth behind all this stuff. You can only see one thing at a time in your head. But when you get it all down on paper, look at it in its entirety, then and only then can we really see
the big picture.
The things that we've been doing in the past, how we've hurt other people with it, how that's created our resentments and our fears and our guilt and remorse. It is only then that we really become willing to do something about this stuff. You know, a lot of that stuff that created problems for others is fun and pleasurable and exciting. And we lived on that all of our life. And sometimes it's hard to change those things. And we're not going to change them until we see the truth behind them. And the truth comes out as we fill out these inventory sheets. And we're going to make one more little suggestion before we leave the inventory in its entirety.
He's got it over there.
It tells us when we get to step 8, we've got the list, we made it, and we took step 4. But we've got some names off of the resentment sheet. We've got some off of the fear sheet. We've got some off of the sexual harm sheet. But there's still probably some names of people we've hurt in other areas other than sexual that hasn't really popped up on these sheets yet. So we made up another inventory sheet. We called it a review of harms other than sexual. And we do it just like we did the other sheets. Column 1, who did I hurt? Those that I stole the money from, those that I hurt physically, those that I undercut them, took their job. If their names haven't appeared yet, I'll put them on this sheet. Column 2, what did I do to hurt them? Column 3, what part of self is affected? Column 4, what feelings did I create in others? Did I unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, bitterness, or desire to retaliate? What should I have done instead? And column 5, which character defect is involved? We finish this sheet. Once again, we're doing step 4. We got information for 5, 6, and 7 out in the fifth column. We've got information for steps 8 and 9 in column 1. And we finish this sheet up. We have now completed the inventory. We've looked at our resentments. We've looked at our fears. We've looked at our harms to others, both sexual and in any other way. Now let's see what the book has to say about that. If we've been thorough about our personal inventory, we have written down a lot. We have listed and analyzed our resentments. Now, a lot of people don't like this word analyze. They say utilize rather than analyze. And I think what they're saying is you better start taking action rather than sit around and think. But the word analyze in this particular usage is simply another word that Bill uses for truth. We've taken a truthful, honest, analytical inventory. To analyze something simply means to get down to the truth of it. He didn't say it, but we've listed and analyzed our fears. We've listed and analyzed our sexual harms. We've listed and analyzed harms done to others other than sexual. We've begun to comprehend their futility and their fatality. We have commenced to see their terrible destructiveness. Now listen, here's a promise. We have begun to learn tolerance, patience, and goodwill toward all men, even our enemies. My God, for an alcoholic to begin to learn that. What a radical change in personality is already taking place. For we look on them as sick people. We have listed the people we've hurt by our conduct and are willing to straighten out the past if we can. In this book, you read again and again that faith did for us what we could not do for ourselves. We hope you are now convinced that God can remove whatever self-will has blocked you off from Him. If you already made a decision,
step 3,
and an inventory of your grosser handicaps,
step 4,
you have made a good beginning. That being so, you have swallowed and digested some big chunks of truth about yourself.
Okay, now he knows what he said, our grosser handicaps. Step 4 is just to take our grosser handicaps. When we get into step 10, we'll be using that to refine that process. So I think the greatest mistake is most people, everybody's trying to wait and take a perfect inventory. You know, we want to wait till we get well and take the steps. But what we both do is take steps to get well. And what we have to do is come on in the program and do the best you can with your inventory. And then take step 10 for the rest of your life. We're never going to have perfection. But I see many people making a mistake, waiting around, and then hanging around AA, making everybody else sick, waiting to take the inventory.
What are the grosser handicaps anyhow, Joe?
Resentment, fear, sexual harms, and harms done to other people other than sexual.
What are the grosser handicaps?
Selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightening, and inconsiderate attitudes.
You see, we've looked at those things. We've seen the truth behind them. We're beginning to get rid of some of that. Already the personality change has taken place. We'll continue to work on this for the rest of our lives. So the best we can hope to do with step four is do the best we can. And then that gives us enough information. We can now then continue with the rest of the program. You see, you can't do steps 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9 unless you've done a good step four. So now that we've gathered up all this information in step four, now then let's see what we're going to do with it.
Okay, let's go into page 72. It's called into action. It's not into thinking, but into action. And having made our personal inventory, what should we do about it? It's a good question, isn't it? Well, we've been trying to get a new attitude. Remember that Dr. Jung said ideas, emotions, and attitudes, which is the guiding force. We're trying to get a new attitude. We've seen what they are. And we're trying to get a new relationship with our Creator. And again, back on page 45, it said the main object of this book was to enable me to find a power greater than myself, which would solve my problem. So I'm trying to get a new relationship with my Creator and discover some of the obstacles in my path. And what are some of those obstacles? Resentment, fear, harms done to others, and harms done to others sexually. We have admitted certain defects. And what are these defects? Selfish, dishonesty, self-seeking, frightened and inconsiderate attitudes. Those are the defects. And we have ascertained in a rough way what the trouble is. We have put our finger on the weak items in our personal inventory. Now these are about to be cast out. This requires action on our part, which when completed will mean that we've admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our defects. This brings us to the fifth step in the program of recovery mentioned in the preceding chapter.
And we know that step five says we admitted to God, to ourselves, and another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. But if you'll notice here in the narrative on step five, he said the exact nature of our defects. He used the word wrongs in the step, the word defects in the narrative. It used to confuse people. And people used to ask Bill, they'd say, well, Bill, what's going on here? What's the difference between the word wrongs in step five and the word defects in a narrative, and why did you use two different words? Now, we've known two ladies that worked with and for Bill for years. They both tell us the same thing. That Bill would kind of rear back and smile, and he would say, when I took English and writing courses in college, they taught me never to use the same words over and over, because that shows how dumb you really are. He said, there's no difference in these things. He said, in step four, we're going to find those things that block us off from the sunlight of the Spirit. In step five, we're going to talk about them to another human being. In step six, we're going to become willing to have God remove them. In step seven, we're going to ask Him to take them away. And He said, you can call them anything you want to. A wrong, a fault, a mistake, a defect, a shortcoming, a personality flaw, or whatever. And you're going to find that as he goes through the book, that's exactly what he does. He refers to these terms using different words, all meaning exactly the same thing. So it doesn't make any difference whether we call it the exact nature of our defects or the exact nature of our wrongs. We're going to discuss with another human being what we found out in step four.
Okay. Now, my problem is going to go. This is perhaps difficult, especially discussing our defects with another person. We think we have done well by admitting these things to ourselves. There is doubt that in actual practice, we usually find a solitary self-appraisal insufficient. Many of us thought necessary to go much further. We still be more reconciled by discussing ourselves with another person when we see a good reason why we should do so. The best reason first. If we skip this vital step, we may not overcome drinking. Time after time, the newcomer has tried to keep to themselves certain facts about themselves, trying to avoid his humbling experience. They have turned to easier methods. Almost invariably, they got drunk. Having reserved the rest of the problem, they wondered why they fell. We think the reason is they never completed their house cleaning. They took inventory all right, but hung on some of the worst items in stock. They thought they had lost their egotism and fear. They only thought they had humbled themselves. But they had not learned enough of humility, fearlessness, and honesty in the sense that we find necessary until they told someone else all their life story. Now this is where, when we said when they see this in step five, I don't know why it should affect the inventory because it's in step five. People see that all your life story in step five, and they go then they say, oh, that's what they wanted to do in step four. It has nothing to do with step four. You might tell someone all your life story, but you're not required to do that in step four. Write that down in step. It says this is step five. More than most people, the alcoholic leads a double life. He is very much the actor. To the outer world, he presents his stage character. This is one he likes his fellows to see. He wants to enjoy a certain reputation, but knows in his heart he doesn't deserve it. And the inconsistency is made worse by the things he does on a spree. Come to his senses, he is revoked by certain episodes he vaguely remembers. These memories are a nightmare. He trembles to think someone might have observed him. As fast as he can, he pushes these memories far into himself. He hopes to never see the light of day. He is under constant fear and tension and makes for more drinking.
You know, we go back to this statement, until I told someone else all their life story. And we took that statement and we assumed they wanted us to write our life story in step four, and that's what we did, many of us. But as I talked yesterday, I find that 95% of my life story has nothing to do with my alcoholism anyhow. But I tell you what did have something to do with it. My resentments and my fear and my guilt and my remorse had something to do with it. And if I've done the inventory like the book says, I've shared all my life story resentment-wise. My resentments didn't come just today. They've been popping in my head as far back as I can remember. I've shared all my life story fears-wise. They didn't come in my head just today. They've been popping in my head as far back as I can remember. I shared all my life story guilt, remorse, and harms-wise. I didn't hurt people as today. I've been hurting people as far back as I can remember. My mother said to me one time, she said, Charlie, you were the meanest kid I ever saw. She said, I had a little trouble loving you myself. Mm. When Mama's got a little trouble loving you, you know you're in pretty bad shape. So if I have really, really, really shared my resentments and my fears and my harms and my guilt and my remorse, I've shared all my life story anyhow. That's what all my life story revolved around. The fact that I was born in 1929 has nothing to do with it, period. But those other things do. So we don't really have any quarrel with that statement.
And I like this idea, too. It said a solitary self-appraisal is insufficient. I did the very best I could do with the knowledge that I had and the understanding that I had when I did this inventory. It wasn't great. Nobody that I've ever known has done this perfectly. But I did the best I could do. And now, as important as these forms have been, they're really important now. Because now I can take these to another human being, and he and I can go from these things from left to right, discussing every column in depth as long as I wish to and as long as he wishes to, gleaning all the information about me that I possibly can, and especially the fifth column, because that's really what we're interested in is, what would we selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, frightened, and inconsiderate? And he can help me see things that I couldn't see. Because you see, between me and me, there is a lifetime of rationalization and justification. I can't see through that. I can look around this room this morning, I can see defective characters everywhere.
Right there.
There's one right over there, a big one. Because the only difference between me and you is air. Now, if I had any character defects, I'm sure you could see them. I can see you. Because there's nothing between you and me except air. Between me and me is a lifetime of rationalization and justification. I need another human being help looking at me through this inventory process to help me see things that I couldn't see. a solitary self-appraisal is insufficient.
Last paragraph on page 73 says, psychologists are inclined to agree with us. We spent thousands of dollars for examinations. We know but few instances where we've given these doctors a fair break. We have seldom told them the whole truth, nor have we followed their advice. Unwilling to be honest with these sympathetic men, we were honest with no one else. You know, let's face the fact. We alcoholics have become the world's greatest con artists. You have to be if you're going to be a practicing alcoholic. You've got to learn how to lie, con, manipulate, cheat, steal, take advantage of others, and etc. if you're going to be a practicing alcoholic. Have you been doing that for 10, 15, 20, 30, or 40 years? You come to AA. You take step four. You be just as honest with yourself as you possibly can. But we got to face the fact it's impossible for us to be honest with ourselves. You know, we had that little thing called resentments, a very convenient thing that we used it to transfer blame to others so we never would have to look at ourselves. We've never been honest with ourselves or anybody else. So if we really want to see what our problems are, we're going to have somebody else help us see them. No human being, I don't care how perfect they are, can be entirely honest with themselves because of the three basic instincts of life that enter into the picture and cause us to rationalize and justify, and that's especially true for we alcoholics. We just can't see the truth about ourselves. Now, I know confession is good for the soul. I know if you belong to a religion that requires it, you need to go do that. But I also know that we ought to be taking step five with somebody that really knows and understands this program, that understands 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9, according to the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous. They can help us see those things that it's impossible for us to see. Page 74, that deals with who to take it with. And this was very valid in 1939, because in 1939 we didn't have AA sponsors. We didn't have very many people that were knowledgeable about this program. And it suggested we go to a priest or we go to somebody else to take this. That isn't true any longer. We've got plenty, plenty of good AA people, plenty of good AA sponsors that fully understand steps 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9 according to the Big Book. That's really who we need to be taking step 5 with. Page 75 tells us how to take step 5, Joe.
When we decided who is to hear our story, we waste no time. We have a written inventory, and we are prepared for a long talk. We explain to our partner what we're about to do and why we have to do it. He should realize that we are engaged upon a life and death errand. Most people approaching this way would be glad to help. They'll be honored by our confidence. We pocket our pride and go to it, illuminating every twist of character, every dark cranny of the past.
Here's the results and some more promises.
Once we have taken this step, without holding nothing, we are delighted. We can look the world in the eye. We can be alone at perfect peace and ease. Our fears fall from us, and we begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. We may have had certain spiritual beliefs.
Step two, where we came to believe.
But now we begin to have a spiritual experience. The feeling that the drink problem is disappearing will often come strongly. We'll feel we're on a broad highway, walking hand in hand with the spirit of the universe. Now here's the second results of the steps. You know, we got results out of the action step. We didn't get any out of step one. Step one just showed the problem. Two just showed the solution. Three was nothing but a decision, so we don't get much for a decision. Step four is the first action step. And then step four brought us some results. And the next personality change takes place in step five. We're going to have personality change as a result of all the other action steps.
Now, if you have done steps four and five, you've done a lot of work. You're probably tired.
Need a rest.
You probably need to rest a little bit. The book is now going to give you a little rest stop. He said, returning home, we find a place where we can be quiet for an hour.
For an hour.
He didn't say 72 days, did he? He said an hour.
1 hour.
Every time he's referred to time in this book, it's been a very short period of time. Carefully reviewing what we've done, we thank God from the bottom of our heart that we know Him better. We don't know Him yet, but we know Him better. Taking this book down from our shelf, we turn to the page which contains the 12 steps. Carefully reading the first 5 proposals. Now, he didn't want to use steps again, so he called them proposals. Carefully reading the first 5 steps or proposals, we ask if we've omitted anything, for we're building an arch to which was to walk a free man at last. Is our work solid so far? Are the stones properly in place? Have we skimped on the cement put into the foundation? Have we tried to make mortar without sand? Once again, we're referring to the wonderfully effective spiritual structure through which we're going to pass to freedom. Step 1 was the foundation. Step 2 was the cornerstone. Step 3 was the keystone. And we were told we're building an arch and we're going to pass through it to freedom. We ask ourselves these questions, and on page 76, it says we can answer to our satisfaction. We then look at step 6. We've emphasized willingness as being indispensable. Are we now ready to let God remove from us all the things which we have admitted are objectionable? Can He now take them all, every one? If we still cling to something we will not let go, we ask God to help us be willing. And if you'll notice, He didn't say a thing about defects of character. That's all of step 6. He did so those things which we have admitted are objectionable. Now surely when we took our inventory and we took step 5, and we saw that type of character we had become over there in column 5, that old selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, frightened, and inconsiderate character, then surely those things are objectionable to us by now. Are we ready to turn them loose? If we are, then we're already through with step 6. Then he says, when ready, we say something like this: My Creator, I'm now willing you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character. Whoop! We're in step 7 now. Step 7 said shortcomings. Here he calls them defects of character. You see what he's done to us? He really, really confused us for a long time. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen. We have then completed step 7. Are you ready to have God remove those defects of character? If you are, you're through with 6. Have you humbly asked Him to remove your shortcomings? If you have, you've done 7. One paragraph on each one of these 2 steps.
There's always a paradox in AA, and a paradox means everything's just backwards from what you think it is. Yeah. If you keep that in mind in AA, you'll have it a lot better. Everything's backwards. For instance, the paradox here is, if you don't want to know what a paradox is, how many of you ever called your sponsor so you could listen? Supposed to, yeah, call because we want to talk, right? We need to call so we can listen. But the paradox here is that the 2 of the biggest steps in all of Alcoholics Anonymous is on 2 little paragraphs. That's the paradox. We almost missed that. You know, by the time I got around to this area, I could see what I had become through the inventory process and through looking at myself through with another human being. I could see what I had become. And a little doubt began to creep into my mind. I mean, can God really, do this? And I had to remember what a line that I heard earlier. God either is or He isn't. God is everything or else He's nothing. He either can or He can't. What was my choice to be? And I chose to believe that He could, you see. And these are the tools of change. The tools of change. To change from what I had become to that which God intends for me to be. You can't heal a sick mind with a sick mind. I can't just get from here to there because I want to. I have to have 6 and 7 to get me from where I had become to that which God intended for me to be. There was a story in that other book, that other big book, this guy's name was Judas. Judas could not accept what he had done. You know what he did? Killed himself. And today there's people running around saying, you just walk around and accept this, accept that. Acceptance? Acceptance is a process. It's not an event. Acceptance is a process. It's not an event. Acceptance comes after 4, 5, 6, and 7. And we found the facts, we face the facts, then we engage in a process to accept the facts. We come to the acceptance after 6 and 7. I know what I used to be like, and I'm not that way today, thank God, primarily because of 4, 5, 6, and 7, and especially 6 and 7. Surely God can change me from what I have become to that which he intends for me to be, because he has
seeing them, analyzing them, getting down to the truth of what they're doing to us, and then talking this over with another person in step 5. These things should, by this time, be objectionable to our character. If it's not objectionable, we're not going to do anything about it. We still think it's got some value. When we look at the stock in trade, the value of it, by this time, this stuff should be objectionable. And we become willing to let go of it. Now, you know, we're going to make this two things. You got to do two things. You got to be willing to let go of it, and you got to ask God to remove it. And then, like changing, if you want to change your tire, you got two jobs. You got to take one tire off first, and then you got to put nothing on. So step 6 is taking the old one off, and step 7 is putting the new one on. You got really two parts of the job, two parts to one job.
Well, if you want to lose some weight, Joe.
You want to lose some weight, you got to do the same thing. You know, losing weight's got to, it's the same principle as losing weight. You know, our bodies are results of what we put into them, what we eat. Whatever we eat, we become. Our minds and the same, personality is the same way. Personality is the result of the thoughts we put into our mind. We put this garbage into our mind a little bit over the years, you know, just picking up a piece here and picking up a piece here, and from this source and that source. You know, I picked up some junk from some people who didn't believe it themselves. I bought into it and put it into my life, and I had to live it. But this stuff become objectionable because of the pain it caused in my life. And, you know, when we lose weight, I had to quit eating all that pie and cake Lou Bell cooks. I had to quit eating those jelly beans I loved to eat on Sunday and watch the ball game.
You had to quit eating the things you wanted to eat.
And I had to make myself eat some broccoli and carrots and some of that stuff.
All those things you don't want to eat.
That's right. You know, and they tell me I never have reached a point, though. They tell me if you ever lose the weight, the carrots and the broccoli start tasting good. We will never know that if we don't do this. But we're 100%. And if we're going to get something new, we got to take out. So we got to be willing to give up something in order to gain something. Real simple. Simple but not easy. Very difficult. His principles of change are very simple. Losing weight, changing our bodies, changing our minds is the same principle. You know, the great, years ago, many, a great writer in the Bible said that they asked him, how do you change? He said, you got to die so you can live. You know, you got to die somewhere so you can live somewhere new. And only we can slay ourselves with inactivity. You know, these old ideas in my mind for a period of time, these defects were there because I had put them in there. And they cried out to be answered. But I can't even do that no more. And they begin to die, and new things begin to take their place. So the process of change, we can change and change and change to go anywhere we want to. You know, I realize how blessed we are as alcoholics. So we have the ability to change. Most people out there, and I watch people all the time, I'm very interested in all people. Most people out there are trapped in whatever they are. They can hear many times you say, I'm just the way I am. I feel sorry for them people. Because they're trapped right where they are, froze in life. But we have the opportunity through a problem in our life. We've been given some tools that other people don't have to fashion our own happiness and our own contentment. And it's how we use these. There's no end to the happiness we can have. It's all up to us. If we use the tools, these two wonderful tools called 6 and 7.
When I got to 6 and 7, knowing that God was all-powerful, I assumed that all I need to do is turn to God, ask Him to take these things away. He would give me the $29.95 special, and He would zap me and make me as pure as the driven snow. I found out it doesn't work that way. God will do for me what I can't do for myself. He will not do for me what I can do for myself. I do not have the power to remove a character defect. Only God has that power. But what I can do is determine the opposite of that character defect. And I ask God to take away my selfishness, and then I start trying to practice with God's help and all the willpower I can muster, unselfishness in any situation that comes up. And slowly, slowly, over a period of time, the old idea of selfishness dies, and a new idea takes its place. And I find today, in a majority of the cases, I react with unselfishness rather than selfishness. If I want God to take away my dishonesty, then I've got to start practicing honesty. And I can't do that by myself, but with God's help and all the willpower I can muster, I can force myself to be honest in every situation that comes up. Slowly, the old idea dies, a new idea takes its place. In the majority of the cases, I find I react today with honesty rather than dishonesty. If wanting to take away my self-seeking, frightened character, then I've got to start practicing courage. I've got to muster all the willpower I can, and with God's help, I've got to start making myself do things I was afraid to do, and just as importantly, quit doing things I was afraid to quit. And slowly, slowly, I find that I react today to most situations with faith and courage. If I want Him to take away in consideration, then I have got to start considering other people, their needs and their wants, put them ahead of my own. It's hard for me to do that. I can't do it by myself. But with all the willpower I can muster and God's help, I can force myself to be considerate and some courage. I've got to muster all the willpower I can, and with God's help, I've got to start making myself do things I was afraid to do, and just as importantly, quit doing things I was afraid to quit. And slowly, slowly, I find that I react today to most situations with faith and courage. If I want Him to take away in consideration, then I have got to start considering other people, their needs and their wants, put them ahead of my own. It's hard for me to do that. I can't do it by myself. But with all the willpower I can muster and God's help, I can force myself to be considerate. And slowly, slowly, I find in a majority of the cases today that I act and react with consideration for others rather than for myself. You see, when I got here, my mind was a set of mental habits developed in 40 years of living. The habitual thing for me was to be selfish. The habitual thing was to be dishonest. The habitual thing was to be frightened. The habitual thing was to be inconsiderate. Now, if I want to change that, I've got to work against myself. And slowly, slowly, as God removes, as I practice the opposite, the old habit dies, and I become an entirely different human being. I think we're the luckiest people in the world. We have the opportunity to live 2 lifetimes in 1 lifetime. I'm beginning to understand what the book says when it says we were reborn in our minds. I'm not what I used to be. I'm beginning to understand what it says. Some of us tried to hold on to the old ideas, and the results were nil. I can't stay selfish and become unselfish at the same time. God cannot take these things away from me unless I am willing. He gave me self-will. He will not take it back unless I do my part. And steps 6 and 7 are two of the steps that Bill added to the Oxford Group program. They had step 4 and 5. But Bill said, we alcoholics need something stronger than that. We need something to help us change. And he added step 6 and 7 so we could work on the things we've been talking about and start the change, and we'll never be through with it. It'll be part of our life from now on. We'll be working on this change. Now be careful. If you buy into this idea, that means from this day on, you are responsible for what you are. I can't blame it on Mother any longer. I can't blame it on Daddy. I can't blame it on Barbara. Can't blame it on God. Today I know what's wrong with me. I know how to change me. And it's my responsibility to make the changes with God's help. I no longer have the luxury of blaming anything on anybody.
You know, most places, people out there in society want to be victims. Everybody's a victim today of something. But thank God in Alcoholics Anonymous, we won't let each other become victims. We say, no, that's your responsibility. You're not a victim. You've had some shabby treatment, sure, but you're not the victim, only if you think you are. There's a way to change here from what you have become to what God intends for you to be.
Thank you all for being here this morning. We'll see you later today. Everybody says, always says to us, we must be tired because of all the work we're doing. Hell, we're not doing any work. We're doing what we love to do, is talk. The hardest thing is to listen. And I always marvel at you guys being able to do that. I'm not sure I could do it. By the way, I've never heard a big book study. I don't have any idea what it's about. So I've never listened to one of them yet. Someday I'm going to sit in the back of the room and listen to somebody else do it. Hopefully I would learn something when I do that. I noticed when Stu kind of hushed you all became immediately quiet. And I think that is a great display of courtesy. And I think it's a great thing. The first time we saw that, Joe and I were over in England. We'd get ready to start a big book session, and the chairperson would just stand up in front of the room, hold their hand up, and immediately everybody in the room would just get as quiet as they possibly could. They would go ahead and make their announcements, and we would start the big book study. I said, Joe, that's one of the most courteous things I've ever seen. Why don't we try that when we get back home? We did a big book study up in Chicago, and I stood up and I raised my arm at the beginning of the session so everybody would quieten down, and somebody in the back of the room began to wave at me. Somebody about the middle of the room said, what the hell are we voting on anyhow? We found out it didn't always work as well here in the States as it did in England, but it certainly did a while ago, and we thank you for that. We've done a lot of work up to this point. We've been able to see what our problem is. We've been able to see the solution to the problem. We've been able to see the program of action necessary to find that solution. We've started on the program of action by doing our step 4, step 5, step 6, step 7. And we're actually beginning to change as we are doing those action steps. Now, we've heard all of our time in AA, we've heard it said that the 12 steps are a design for living that really works. And for years, we had no idea what that was talking about, but finally, in tying the design for living together with the words that we are spiritually ill, mentally ill, physically ill, we begin to think about what they call the three dimensions of life. All human beings are born to live in three dimensions. You know, if God dwells on each of us, and I'm sure He does because the book says so, then that means we're going to have to live with God whether we like it or not. Now, the only question is, do we live with God in harmony or disharmony? And I don't know of any group of people in the world that ever got in more disharmony with God than we alcoholics have. We also have what we call the mental dimension. Now, we've all got a mind. Sometimes we act like we don't, but we do. And we're going to have to live with our mind, whether we like it or not, is beside the point. And again, the only question is, do we live within our minds in harmony or disharmony? I don't know of any group of people in the world that got in more disharmony in our minds than we alcoholics have. We also have what they call the physical dimension. And for a long, long time, I thought the physical dimension dealt with my body only when it talked about being physically ill. But today I realize the physical dimension is the world and everything in it. Other people, my job, my car, everything in the material world as we know it is called the physical dimension. Now, we don't have any place else to live except here on earth. And the only question is, do we live here in harmony or disharmony? And I don't know of any group of people in the world that ever got in more disharmony with the world and everything and everybody in it than we alcoholics have. In other words, we became spiritually sick, mentally sick, and physically sick. Now, it looks to us as though these 12 steps are designed to put us back together in those dimensions so we can become completely well. In step 1, 2, and 3, we got right with God. Because of our powerlessness, we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And in step 3, we made a decision to go after that power. We decided from here on, God is going to be the director. And that's the first time we've had that relationship with God in a long, long time, if we ever had had it before, period. So 1, 2, and 3 got us right with the Spirit. That removed just enough self-will that we could begin to look into our own minds and see what our problems really are. In step 4 and 5, we found out our problems are not other people and other things and institutions, that our problems all lie within ourselves. We found that we had become very selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, frightened, and inconsiderate people. And we found that because of those character defects, we're in constant conflict with the world and everything in it. Through 6 and 7, we begin to work on ourselves, and the change began to really take place. So through 4, 5, 6, and 7, we got right in our minds, in the mental dimension. But it would do me no good to get right with God and get right with myself, unless I get right with my fellow man. Because if I continue to have the difficulties and the problems and the guilt and remorse associated with things I've done in the past, I'm never going to feel comfortable with the world and everything in it. So it looks as though we're going to have to go on to the next 2 steps, step 8 and 9, and they're going to get us right in the physical dimension. Now, if we're right with God and right with ourselves and right with a fellow man, then, of course, we're going to feel pretty good. Nobody likes steps 8 and 9. I've never seen a newcomer come in the door, read the steps off the wall, and say, boy, I can hardly wait until I get to steps 8 and 9. That looks like a lot of fun. Nobody likes to make apologies for things from the past. Nobody likes to take from today's living to pay back things from the past. The only question is, can we afford not to do so? And it seems as though if we're going to be complete, whole human beings, we're simply going to have to do something about that guilt and remorse that's filling up this storeroom in the back of my head that we've never emptied out yet. Now, it's long, long been known that the way you get rid of the guilt and remorse and the bad feelings associated with the harms in the past is you make restitution for those things. And as we make the restitution, then the guilt and the remorse begins to disappear. And then finally, we become complete, whole human beings once again. So let's start looking at steps 8 and 9 for a little bit.
In step 8 and 9, I like steps 8 and 9 today. I didn't used to like them, but I love them today. You know, I have had a lot of horrendous hangovers in my lifetime. I mean horrendous. And I've had been so sick from drinking that I'd be confined to a bed for a week or so. And I would throw up blood and everything else because I was a hard drinker. But you know what? Those things never caused me to want to quit drinking. Ever. Being sick never caused me to want to quit drinking. But what caused me to want to quit drinking was the guilt, shame, and remorse that I had as a result of the harm that I'd done other people. That's what I couldn't stand. And 8 and 9, of course, I didn't know that at the time, but today I look back, it's done more for me than anything that I can say, think of in Alcoholics Anonymous or many other things that has, but certainly 8 and 9 has, because I have been able to make restitution to all those people that I've harmed in all my life, and I'm free. I used to lay awake nights thinking, my mind raced uncontrollably, hour after hour after hour, thinking, if I could just get it back to square one again, if I could just get things back even again with her and him and her and this and that, then I'd be okay. But I didn't know how to go about doing that. Never dawned on me to make amends, of course, because they didn't talk about these kind of principles in the bars that I hung around in.
They didn't talk about making amends in the Zebra Lounge,
no,
did they?
No, not in the Zebra Lounge, they didn't do it.
I know where the Zebra Lounge is, too. Yeah. I'm like Joe, I can still smell it, for sure. I
almost smell it now. Beautiful place. So 8 and 9 are really good steps for cleansing up your life and so you can live free again, be happy, joyous, and free we talk about. I told Franklin one time, I said, Franklin, I'm happy, joyous, and free. He said, Joe, you're not happy, joyous, and free. You're just loose. But 8 and 9 are tremendous steps, and we're going to talk about steps 8 first. So many times in our step study meetings that I've gone to, we start talking about step 8 or studying step 8, and everybody seems to be jumping over to step 9 telling how they went about making amends. But step 8 is a definite step that needs to be done. We'll try to show why here in a little bit. Page 76. He said, now we need more action, without which we find that faith without works is dead. Let's look at steps 8 and 9. We have a list of all persons we have harmed, and to whom we're willing to make amends. We made it when we took inventory. See, all we do now is take all those names off of column 1 of our inventory sheets and put them on one long list. And then we become willing to the list. And if we're not willing, we simply ask God to help us to become willing. See, we haven't made any amends yet. Because we just make the list, become willing to the list. And if we're not willing, we simply ask God to help us to become willing. So now we're about to go out to our fellows and repair the damage done in the past. We attempt to sweep away the debris which has accumulated out of our effort to live on self-will to run the show ourselves. Now, if we haven't the will to do this, we ask until it comes. Remember, it was agreed at the beginning that we would go to any length for victory over alcohol. And again, I just say we ask until it comes. And here in steps 8 and 9, I think, is probably one of the most important places to get with your sponsor to determine how you're going to go about making these amends. Because, I mean, I've seen people go out and try to make amends and cause a whole lot more harm in trying to make amends than they caused in the first place, simply because they didn't know how to go about doing it. So I think we need our sponsors in this area very, very much.
Now, I don't think we've really brought it up yet either. We always hear about the step 3 prayers and step 7 prayers. We never hear about the prayers that are spread all the way through the program of action. From step 3 on, the book recognizes that self cannot overcome self. We had prayer in step 3. We had several prayers in step 4. We're going to have prayer in step 5. We had prayer in 6 and 7. And we also got prayer here involving steps 8 and 9. The book recognizing that self just cannot overcome self. And it says, we made this list of all persons we've harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. And if we're not willing, we ask God to help us be willing. And if we ask God to help us be willing to make these amends, sooner or later, we're going to become willing to make amends to them all. Doesn't mean we're going to make amends to them. We don't make any amends at all in 8. We just make the list and become willing to the list. Now, we should pretty well have the list completed already. Remember, some of those names came off of the resentment sheet. Some of them came off the fear sheet. Some of them came off the sexual harm sheet. Some of them came off of the sheet, harms other than sexual. So we really have already got the list. If we've had thought of some more names since that time, people we've hurt, etc., they need to be added to there. But basically, we've got the list. So the difficult part of step 8 is not the making of the list. The difficult part is becoming willing to make amends to all of those people, whether they've harmed us or whether they've not. Really doesn't make a bit of difference. That's the difficult part of step 8, Joe.
You know, Bill says it twice that in the book that we should have made the list when we took step 4. It's hard, you know, and now we can see why he asked us to do that. You know, if you got this person that you'd harm, you remember that. That's all you got is his name in your mind, and you know you owe him a man. Maybe it seems a little harder. Probably a little harder. But if you put it down and analyze it, and see what happened, and see how you were involved in it, and how it come about, while you do your inventory, then you will want to make amends for him in step 8. So therefore, we analyze that out and see the whole picture. And that makes the amends a lot easier. That's why we asked to make that list while we're doing step 4. We'll have some information and want to make that amend. Be willing to make that amend.
You know, I had a lot of difficulty in becoming willing to make amends to them all, because I felt some of those SOBs had hurt me as bad as I ever hurt them. I'm damned if I'm going to make amends to them. And I really felt that I couldn't do steps 8 and 9 because I wasn't willing to make amends to them all. My sponsor gave me some very, very good advice on how to become willing to make amends to them all. I passed that information on to Joe, and I'm going to ask Joe to pass that information on to you. How we can become willing to make amends to those that we don't even want to make them.
Yeah, I'm like Charlie. I had a lot of people I didn't want to make amends to also, and I didn't know how to go about making amends to those people that I didn't want to make amends to. As a matter of fact, I was so mad at those people and felt that they'd hurt me so bad that they owed me amends that I wouldn't make amends to anybody. So the little formula was real simple, and most things in AA is simple. He said, we take the list and look it over. And there's some people on that list that you would like to make amends to, and you'd probably make it to them right now if you could, wouldn't you? I said, yeah.
That's maybe our children or our brother or our sister or mother. Our father or so on and so forth.
They're really
people
easy.
We'd really like to get straightened out with.
Oh, what's her name? I put her aside for a while. So we take all, let's look down the list of the names and take all those people on that list that we can make amends to right now. And put them on a now list. And then you go about and set the rest of them aside. You go about and you start making amends to those as you can do right now. And once we get those completed, then we can go down to those people who we're willing to make amends to, but maybe not right now, maybe a little bit later. So we take the list and go down the list and pull all those people down there that we can make amends to a little bit later and put them on the list. Talk with my sponsor about how I can go about making amends to those people a little bit later, and then start making those amends a little later. And when we get completed with that, there's some other people on that list still left, those that maybe I'll make amends to and maybe I won't. So I'll look down my list of names I've got left over, and let's find the maybes in there and leave the nevers on the side. And I looked at the maybes and put them down, and by now I'm getting some experience. I'm getting some good feedback. I'm beginning to feel good. You see, and I see the value of making amends. And those people that I maybe make to, I start looking for them to make. Maybe I make, will make amends to them. Some of those people were put into my life. The wherever possible, wherever is made possible by God, I believe. And I begin to make those maybe list. Now those nevers, boy, those nevers are really tough. And so I take the rest of the names off of that list and put them on a list for never going to make amends to them. Except I become willing to the list as time went by and begin to see the value of making these amends. And those nevers begin to crop up one at a time. Some of them I went out looking for them to make amends. You know, step 9 is a definite 3-part step. It tells us when to do it, and what to do, what kind of amends to make, direct amends to wherever possible, and when not to do.